Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a selection of handcrafted party trays for Thanksgiving hosts as well as attendees, including everything from artisan cheeses to a variety of desserts.
The documentary The Last Republican tells the story of Adam Kinzinger. On January 6th of 2021, he was an Illinois Republican congressman, dumbfounded and shaken by what had happened at the Capitol. In those initial hours, he spoke out about Donald Trump and his role in sparking the upheaval. Eventually, he voted to impeach Trump, and he joined the congressional committee investigating the attack. So the film shows how Kinzinger was shunned by his party, how it cost him his political future, how he faced humiliation and ugly threats. And it also explores his relationship with the director, Steve Pink, a committed liberal. They connect over a shared sense of principle and a devotion to the Chicago Cubs and Bears. The film is this meditation on political identity and accountability, but it also has these moments that explore alternate paths. You know, these moments that show how a single decision or event could have altered the course of things. Adam Kinzinger and Steve Pink talked to us about one of these turning points. It was in the weeks after January 6th. And it really seemed like Donald Trump's role as a public figure was over.
It is a stunning moment, Dana. The disgraced 45th president of the United States and First Lady Melania Trump walking to Marine One for their last ride on Marine One ever. That will take them to Joint Base Andrews.
When Donald Trump left office, nobody even showed up to Andrews. I mean, he was persona non grata. He was done.
He looks small. He just looks like a small man.
And so the party was trying to figure out kind of, okay, what are we now? Ultimately, you know, I'm at work and then I get an alert that Kevin McCarthy had gone to Mar-a-Lago.
That changed everything. Because Donald Trump had been disgraced until that moment. Kevin McCarthy was the minority leader, and Kevin told us, I just happened to be down there in Palm Beach, and he wanted to meet, and I'm not going to say no to a former president. Bullshit.
The Republican conference turned on a dime at that point. They recognized that we were told that we had to embrace Donald Trump again. And Kevin McCarthy did it for one reason. He knew he wanted to be speaker, and he knew he could not take on MAGA and be speaker in time to take him out. And so he made that decision, and that turned everything on a dime. I think he owns the resurrection of Donald Trump, and I equate it to basically an ambulance showing up at somebody that's flatlined, and they take those paddles and bring him back to life. That turned not just the Republican Party history a completely different way. It turned obviously the country a different way.
I knew at that moment what would happen.
You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit.
The former president, was he responsible for what happened?
No, of course not.
You think about it. If you actually come to grips with what's happened, that's going to take some soul searching. It's much better to just numb the pain. It's easier.
After careful consideration, I've made the decision to oppose the House Democrats' slanted and unbalanced proposal for another commission to study the events of January the 6th.
Just to torture this analogy, it seems like you would be a great candidate to start Republicans Anonymous.
Yeah, maybe.
You know what I mean? Like, you could have, yeah. Hi, my name is Jim Jordan.
No, but then we're just feeding into your little left wing, like, oh, every Republican is just a Democrat waiting to find his wings.
Oh, definitely.
I was coming at it from a slightly different perspective. I was searching for Adam's state of mind. So, you know, from my point of view, I was like, you know, you did this courageous thing by risking your political career, ultimately having to endure death threats for your family. And how does one, you know, come to a decision where you're going to do that? And what I found so fascinating was that he didn't necessarily anticipate that. He actually, because he was a man of conviction and he had the set of truly held beliefs and is actually your job description to uphold the Constitution, that he felt like in the moment where there was this vacuum and Trump was persona non grata. And it was interesting to me that Adam thought that they would get over their hangover and then right themselves and be a party of principle and then go forward, you know, beyond Donald Trump. And when Adam said, yes, he truly believed that, I felt like, well, that's a really courageous act in a particular way. So I was coming at it from, you know, his personal story and how these giant and momentous events actually were affecting his personal life and how he made his decisions.
I wish I could transport everybody back to the psychology of that moment, because it was a pretty well understood feeling that Trump was done. And so it's a lesson to me that in moments where you think, like, I have to avoid doing the tough thing and just hope things shake out, that's not the case. There's nobody that's going to ride in on a white horse, particularly when you're at that level. You are the people with the white horses. You have to ride in on them, or else the folks on the dark horses are going to come in.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Last Republican is the latest film in our documentary series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it tonight, the Film Center's new building on 4th North in the Marmalade District. We have details about that on our website. Apart from the themes of sacrifice and loyalty and institutional integrity, the film reveals this unlikely relationship between Adam Kinzinger, who, when this all started, was a conservative Republican, and Steve Pink, a Hollywood filmmaker who describes himself as a democratic socialist. Their differences and their evolving rapport are part of the story. And guess where they first met? Here in Utah.
Yeah, it was Utah, right? Right, Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there doing something, and we met up in a bar at the hotel I was staying at. And look, we had had, I mean, I had had, I say 100, probably, you know, a dozen or so people that wanted to do a documentary. And all of them were like, oh, you know, you're going to run again and we want to follow the election. Right. And I had no interest in that. But they kind of pitched this idea of the human element of it, you know, the impact, the toll. And so that's when we met. And, you know, obviously Sophia and I took that back and came to the conclusion we wanted to do it. But yeah, I also, you know, we talk about how our relationship developed kind of through the film, but when I met Steve right away, I mean, I knew that, you know, he wasn't going to be somebody I can have a good read on people. And I knew he wasn't going to be somebody I didn't enjoy being around. I'll put it that way. Okay. And so that helped. I'd be curious, Steve, on your end, how that went down.
Yeah.
So we go down to Utah, and I don't want to do this stuff. I don't care about Adam Kinzinger. Great. He was courageous. I don't care, really. I didn't really have a sense of what he had done at that moment, but I was like, the last thing being, you know, since I consider myself, you know, a far left progressive, I would say a Bernie Sanders progressive, and I'm just not interested in spending a couple of years of my life making a film about someone on the right. And, you know, but then I did, because I had did some research, and I was like, oh, okay, well, I might have this guy wrong. I didn't really understand, you know, what his biography was to this point, and it's fascinating. And I realized, by reading about him and getting a sense of him, and the fact that he was from Illinois too. Like, I don't know, like people who, you know, to me, when you know someone's from your state, we're both Midwestern people. There's a set of shared values I felt like I could identify with no matter what his political views were, because I love my state and love where I'm from. And, you know, and I have a, you know, close kinship with, you know, my people. And so I was like, well, he's from Illinois, so how bad could he be?
Yeah.
You know, we all sat down together, and I remember being a little bit belligerent and saying to him, you know, were, you know, it not for the fact that the country has been turned upside down and you, you know, engaged us in really, you know, this act of courage. It was, you know, he's essentially a profile in courage at that point. You would be a terrible documentary subject. It's like, I don't. And I said that in front of him and all his staffers, and I said it mainly to be belligerent. Just to see how his staff would react, right? And then how Adam would react. And Adam, of course, laughed. his staff was frozen, right? With, you know, understandably, you were like, who is this jerk coming in and saying something like that to the congressman to his face? Like, that's not nice. But Adam got the joke right away. And in that moment, I also realized, like, well, this guy's cool. Like, this guy's very self-aware and normal. You know, like, if he had been whatever, the way people view politicians, sometimes you view politicians as wooden or fake or, you know, not just like conversant, like a normal, you know, like just like one of us, you know, and some politicians, and I met some of them in Washington, don't actually have the ability to have a conversation that isn't on the record, you know, like, so they don't seem like it doesn't seem like real interpersonal communication. And Adam, of course, is not like that. And then, you know, in terms of the documentary and the thrust of it, yeah, Adam's right. Like I was more interested in telling a profiling courage story rather than, say, you know, an election story, a campaign story. Because campaign stories and documentary are very common because you have, you know, you have something to hang your structure of your movie on, right? It's a competition film. Whereas this was going to be, you know, more an intimate portrait of somebody who had taken a stand and had sacrificed a great deal for it. And I thought that was a really interesting story. And I thought it was something that would be incredibly relatable beyond politics. Like, what does it take to make a decision that could threaten your career? Would you do that? And what does it take to stand on principle? And what are the sacrifices you make when you stand on principle? And those were all very interesting questions for me. And Adam was generous in his, you know, letting us do that. Because it's like, in order for us to tell that story, we're like, okay, well, we're going to be at your house a lot. Like, we're going to have cameras basically following you around informal spaces. Like, this was going to be a very personal story, and for them to trust us and be, you know, in front of the cameras for as long as they were, you know, I think that was just courageous of them in its own right.
Adam, it seems like, so Steve, you've talked about the fact that you had to reconcile a few things yourself in your brain, like, because you guys are way far apart on a lot of the political stuff, but on the one hand, you didn't agree on it.
Well, not so much anymore.
Well, maybe not so much anymore, right? Then. Yet you admired what he had done. But I think it's interesting, Adam, that it seems like you also had to reconcile a few things. There's this moment early on in the film as you guys are sort of working out how you feel about each other and what the relationship's kind of going to be like. And Adam, you are worried about who you and your team were going to be able to trust in those early days. Mm-hmm. And Adam, you say this on camera, you're sort of joking, but there seems to be some truth to it, that you recognize Steve has contempt for everything that you believe. And in fact, you just sort of come out and say that.
I recognize it. Like, you have contempt for what I believe, like in terms of my political viewpoints. Like, you don't, I think in any other situation, you probably would be protesting my office. You're just so far left.
First of all, it's kind of mean.
Yeah, it is.
That's kind of mean that you would think I would have contempt for your views.
Yeah.
Why would you think that?
Do you have contempt for my views, Steve?
It's a really honest kind of question. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. I mean, look, when you make a decision to open your life like that, right? You know, and keep in mind, in a political world, we're all paranoid because you just say the wrong thing. You're seen doing the wrong thing and you can end your career. And, you know, let's say you slip and say a word you shouldn't say. And I knew that, you know, bringing him in on those moments, am I going to say something that could be taken out of context? Or am I going to get upset and do something? Or, you know, or is it that this left wing guy wants to come and make me look like a jackwagon? Right. Is that possible? And you ultimately have to take a leap of faith and trust. And it's not like I lived with this constant paranoia, but, you know, it's something that was on the back of my mind. And then, you know, as we're getting ready to do this kind of long interview where I'm sitting there throughout the whole movie, you know, Sophia and I were talking the night before and we were both actually pretty nervous. We're like, okay, well, this is the last time really that the cameras are going to be on us. And I don't think it was the last, actually, my retirement was, but this is close to the last time. It's the last time I'll be talking. If we don't do this, we can probably kill the film now. And it's like, you know, they could make us look stupid. And so as much as we trusted these guys, as much as I like Steve, there was that reality that this could change everything. But it goes to show, you know, we decided that we were going to let them in and be vulnerable and hope it had an effect. And it, I think it did. And I think you see that throughout the film.
There's a kind of honesty about the interplay that I, and there's a moment I wanted to ask you about, Steve, where it seemed like you were being really transparent here also. And it's the time when Adam says out loud what you figure Steve thinks about people like you at the time, that is, you know, Republicans, is that you probably, Steve, you were, this is you saying, you probably have this idea that every Republican is just a Democrat waiting to find his wings. Like, it'll just be a moment before your eyes will be opened and you'll come to the truth and you'll become a good progressive like me. And I like the way you just sort of acknowledge the sort of natural differences there. And it seems really, I don't know, it seems to build a kind of trust with the audience to be able to be this honest. I don't know. Steve, you want to say something about that?
One of the things that I learned, you know, because it's not like everyone has the opportunity to be hanging out with someone who not only has opposing political views, but it's their, but they're actually legislators, like federal legislators who engage in politics officially at the highest level, right? Like, it's not like you get to hang out, you know, unless you're friends with a congressperson or something. And so for me, at first, you know, I was coming at Adam with a vengeance because I wanted to basically explain to Adam that all of his political views were incorrect. And it sometimes things, very early on also, things kind of would get hot and I would be, you know, probably more belligerent than I thought. And then I was like, what am I doing? I'm trying to make a documentary here and I'm going after him about his politics. And he would refuse, you know, he's, you know, as versed, I would say more versed in some political issues than I am, because that's what he does for a living. And he would be able to push back, you know, quite easily in some areas. And what I realized was that, A, that was useless. And B, there was really no point in it unless there was another kind of relationship that was forming. And so then my focus kind of turned on just kind of being not only the documentarian of his life, but just kind of getting to know who Adam was as a person. And I know that sounds really obvious, but when you're getting to know someone as a person, suddenly all of these, like all the political views you hold on to so dearly, they don't become the way in which you decide whether you like someone or not. Mm. Because we formed the basis of a really, really good friendship, it seemed like actually that's the way through until you're really like seeing someone and understanding who they are and what and realizing that they are you in good faith and that you they're good people at heart. And they have to have they have to be people who want to, you know, engage in good faith. And obviously Adam does. And so suddenly, like, my orientation was not even to ask about politics after a while, because I didn't need to, because it wasn't something that was between us anymore. Our political views were secondary or even tertiary to the friendship that we had formed. And I think that that became an important part of the movie. This is a movie about, you know, how civil discourse, you know, comes out of, you know, seeing the other person and their humanity and forming, you know, a friendship with your fellow, you know, citizen, basically.
The film explores Adam's really, really weirdly early interest in politics, which is kind of incredible just how interested he was early on. One of the things, Congressman, you say in the film is that it was the fanfare of it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? Like, what was that about you that when you were this little kid, you were interested in the mayoral race and national politics?
Well, my spiritual side of it says that I think God kind of authors into everybody's heart what you're going to be. And you can see flashes of that when you're young. And the flashes of it when I was young were pretty bright. And I mean, I it's almost crystal clear. I was 5 years old, I think, you know, which is a year older than my son, which is insane. And we're driving home from church and I just see these pink yard signs, cause it's, you know, the '80s and pink. And I was obsessed, and I don't know why. It was just that it became so cool to me that people were putting out signs and there was this competition. And, you know, I didn't know obviously a ton about governance or governing, but I liked the competition. The competition drew me in. And that, you know, once you like that part of it, then the rest kind of falls into place. An interest in what is this really for? You know, what is government? Okay, government in and of itself is competition. I always loved service. You know, I always admired my grandfather who fought in World War II. And so that, you know, government is service. And obviously, eventually my time in the military. And I think it all just, it started out as like eye-catching. It's almost like walking by a store and there's a suit in the window that catches your eye, and you end up going in the store and buying something else because you get your eye caught, but you, it ends up drawing you in. And I kind of see it as similar to how politics worked for me. I don't know. You know, if we didn't live in Jacksonville, Florida, and I wouldn't have seen those yard signs that day, would I be in politics? I don't know. Probably, because, again, it seems like that's where I was supposed to go. But you know, I really don't know.
Steve, what did you make of that?
I thought it was hilarious. I mean, talking about a young kid, you know, and you see it in the movie, there's literally pictures of him, pictures of Adam with his own campaign, like, store,
what
or whatever you call it, like, in his bedroom.
You know, come on by and get a sign. But it was my room, so just my parents coming by.
He's been serious about this.
Yeah.
For a long time.
That was so stupid.
I remember when he would go out and after it would rain, he'd put out all these political signs.
And go dry them off.
And he'd get on his bike as soon as the rain was over with a cloth and he'd go and wipe off the rain off of every sign.
That was Adam. And,
yep, that happened. What is he doing?
You know, that it just, it supports the idea that he had the conviction, even if it was unformed at that point, to be of service in some way. And he spent his whole life doing it. It's like saying you want to become an astronaut and become an astronaut, or you want to become, you know, whatever, a Major League Baseball player, and then you actually become that thing. Like, that's, it starts very, you know, the people who you see become Major League Baseball players or rock, you know, rock stars or do anything at the highest level, it usually is the story that they started when they were, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years old, right? So it's not surprising in a way that Adam's career went the way it was, since his interest in it started so young.
Steve Pink, he directed the film The Last Republican. We also have with us Adam Kinzinger. The film is the latest in our Through the Lens series. We're going to be screening it tonight at the Utah Film Center's new building on 4th North in the Marmalade District. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a selection of handcrafted party trays for Thanksgiving hosts as well as attendees, including everything from artisan cheeses to a variety of desserts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the latest film in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. This film is The Last Republican. It's the story of Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who broke from his party over January 6th. Kinzinger voted to impeach Donald Trump over all of this. He joined the congressional committee investigating what happened, and he was ostracized by his party, by his friends. He faced threats against himself and his family. But in the film, Kinzinger says it wasn't a political decision. He said it was about a red line he couldn't cross. So it's a story about loyalty versus principle and the integrity of institutions, but also what this might tell us about democracy today. We have with us Adam Kinzinger and the director of the documentary, Steve Pink.
I want to talk about the moment when it seems like things really do start to change. There's the question of the election of 2020. That leads up, obviously, to January 6th. And Congressman, you say in the film something interesting. You say it wasn't political in the sense that it was what it means to turn against everything you've ever belonged to. That's how you put it. Because of some red line you can't cross. What's the red line? What do you mean?
I mean, for me, it's hard to say what the red line is simply because I think it was so obvious. But unfortunately, nobody else, you know, with one exception, Liz Cheney, nobody else. Well, I guess you can count the other impeachers. You know, everybody else was willing to cross it. I mean, it's just simply an oath to the Constitution. I mean, look, the thing that's crazy to me is, like, you know, democracy, I've learned, is actually the hardest form of government. I used to think it was the easiest, but it's the hardest. And it's especially hard if you break this basic understanding of trust. And, you know, if we were playing baseball, Steve and I are both Cubs fans. So if we're playing the Cardinals at Wrigley and all of a sudden the Cubs make a decision that since they're playing at home, they're just going to run to third and then run to home. And the person at the scoreboard is going to put up a one. all of a sudden, if people just start writing their own rules, the game of baseball's over and it'll never be played again. And democracy is the same way. Once you break that red line of saying an election that was stolen, or an election that was free and fair was rigged, you break people's trust in that process. And when people's trust is broken, I mean, eventually, whether it's that year or later, eventually there's violence. I mean, we revolted. We had a violent revolution against a king because we felt like our voices weren't being heard. It's in our DNA. And so, you know, for me, it's just sitting there knowing what my oath to the Constitution was, knowing how simple it was to know what the right thing to do. And then when I say, you know, it's about what does it mean to turn against everything? It's like, I did that. And then all of a sudden I realized what it would cost me. And I've come to realize in time, like, I think people are more likely to give their life for something than they are to give their identity or to give their tribal affiliation up. You know, I think 9 out of 10 adults, if they see a toddler about to get hit by a train, they would jump in front of that train to save the toddler, even if they didn't know the toddler. I don't think 9 out of 10 adults would give up their identity, their affiliation, their tribe, if it would be the right thing, because we're tribal people. That's how we find safety. That's the thing that we're most afraid of, is being isolated and alone. And that, to me, I would say the wisdom I pulled out of just even that short time is like, yeah, I mean, those are decisions that are very hard to make. And it's why very few people make them. You know, I think back, and I'm not comparing myself to him by any means, but I think back to like Winston Churchill, who for 10 years was on the outs. He was called a warmonger. Everybody thought he was insane talking about Hitler. And then he ends up being exactly the person that the UK and the Allies needed at that time. There's a reason we know his name, because not many people were willing to take the same stand he did.
Steve, there's this moment you capture in the film. It's the time that Adam learns that in the process of redistricting in 2021, that the state of Illinois has redrawn his congressional district. It was basically eliminates it. They merge it with another Republicans. And it meant that Adam was going to have to run against this Republican who is supported by Donald Trump. It was a heavily Republican district. And he chooses just, I'm not going to deal with that. I'm not going to seek reelection. And Steve, you've talked about that moment as being, well, this is one of the things I saw you say about this, that it was a moment when everything transformed right before your eyes.
Well, yeah,
talk about this moment because you're saying that as a filmmaker, like, what transformed, and what did this mean for the making of this film?
I think it was literally, it was in Utah, wasn't it? I think so. Yeah. And it was our first day of shooting, right? So we don't know anything. We're just, Adam's shooting this kind of political ad, and we're going to capture it, and we're just kind of sitting in the background. You know, it's a giant political decision to make, right? Is he going to run against, you know, and there's a lot of nuances that I'll circle back to in a second that I didn't understand, but he has to make this essentially momentous, maybe the most important decision in his political life right in front of us.
Now, Kinzinger has served 6 terms in Congress, but newly approved congressional maps put Congressman Adam Kinzinger in the same district as Darren LaHood.
That new district voted 60% for President Trump, a deep red pro-Trump district.
They drew me in a very unfavorable district with a kind of crazy MAGA guy, and I knew there was no way I could run in a primary and win.
Well, there's no good timing.
There's no good timing. Yeah.
If you're not going to run, there's no good timing.
Yeah.
If we announce this week, you're no longer part of the party and you're no longer influential.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that very bad news came in the middle of you doing like 1,000 takes for a political ad about finding common ground.
Some leaders in Washington have forgotten the purpose of democracy.
Some leaders in Washington.
Some leaders in Washington.
Some leaders in Washington have focused.
That was a rough day for you.
It could be a little more.
What?
It could be an umpire.
Like, his political future and his future in general was just unknown in that tournament at the time. And it was just one of the moments that transformed the story we were telling in all these ways that was, you know, impossible to predict. And I couldn't believe it was happening before our eyes.
So there's a story, a really important story that is influential to Adam's story that happens before January 6th. It's in 2006. Adam's visiting Milwaukee, comes across this man attacking a woman. He was cutting her throat with a knife. It's a pretty brutal story. And Adam, you step in.
I had left a German restaurant at 12:26 in the morning, and I'm walking to my car. I hear a commotion, and this girl's running at me, holding her throat, you know, bleeding out, really. You know, they say in a crisis, half of the people run, 40% freeze, and 10% act. I felt every one of those emotions. If somebody would have whispered run to me, I would have run. But there were two immediate thoughts that went through my head. The first one was like, if I act, I'm gonna die. The second one was, if I watch this girl, this lady die, and I did nothing, I can't live with myself the rest of my life.
And we see this in the film, you sort of working this out. You had to work out whether to help her, because what that was going to mean was, all right, I'm probably going to die. So what's the thing you're working out there? And Steve, I want to hear you later about what this moment also says about Adam Kinzinger.
Yeah, I mean, look, when, you know, I had just gotten back from a deployment, just a couple week fun deployment, and, you know, went out with a buddy and my girlfriend at the time, and, you know, walking back, and this thing goes down, and it's like, you know, like if you've been in a car wreck or you've ever seen like a shooting or a murder or anything, everything slows down, right? And that's actually because your brain processing power increases. So relatively, it seems like everything's slower. And so I saw this girl running at me, guys following her. And I mean, it's like August or something. And I'm thinking, oh, this must be a Halloween movie or something like that, right? You just, and then very quickly, it's like, no, this is real. And so it's all in a quarter of a second, basically. I'm sitting here thinking, okay, if this guy had a pistol, I'd be more apt to fight him than I would a knife, because a pistol's lethal, but lethal in one direction for a moment. You know, a knife is lethal everywhere. But the second part that went through that, so I was like, look, if I fight him, I'm going to die. The second part, though, was like, look, man, I guess I was a lieutenant at the time. I'm a military officer. Like, I'm somebody that can make a difference here and intervene. If I watch him kill her and I stand back, that's a moment that I'll never live down. I mean, I don't know if I could, honest to God, live with myself with that. And how could I ever talk to any future kids about courage? And believe it or not, like, maybe not the can I ever talk to future kids, but like all that stuff went through my head in about a quarter of a second. And so, you know, I made the decision, obviously, to intervene. And the thing is once you give your life up for a cause, really, I mean, that's because I mentally did that. And I also made a decision to kill him. So those are two pretty serious decisions to make in your life, even though thankfully I didn't have to with him. You know, it changes your calculus of risk and reward. And all of a sudden, if you were willing to die, you know, it's not like I wake up every day with this feeling, but kind of in a grand scheme, it's like, well, every day is kind of a gift. Every day is kind of unearned. It didn't need to be here. And so it makes decisions, I think, like, am I going to put my career on the line? Am I going to do that? It makes those decisions more likely to be in the affirmative or easier, because the risk in relative comparison to risking your life is much smaller. I mean, to some people that have never been faced any version of danger, giving up your career is the most dangerous thing ever. So it feels extremely awful. Well, if you were willing to give up your life, then all of a sudden that feels not very dangerous and not very big of a sacrifice. So I think it changed my life. Certainly, you know, and I'm glad I made the decision, simply because I don't know if I could have even looked in the mirror for the rest of my life if I had.
Steve, what do you see in that moment that was important for the film, but also for telling Adam's story?
Well, it was an extraordinary moment in our interview, because earlier in the movie, you see me asking about the event, and he's telling me the story of the event. And so I get the story of the event, and then I kind of move on in the interview. And there's something, I don't know why, there was something about our day or day and a half of interviews, and I just wanted to revisit it, because often Adam, you know, would not talk about things in terms of his, you know, personal feelings about them. He would tell me, you know, he would say, kind of speak broadly about the scope and ramifications of the things in his life, but not always kind of tell me how he really felt about those things. And so I was like, God, I don't think I really asked him how he felt and what was really going on there. I think I got to ask him again, like what he was thinking in that moment and why he made the decisions he made, not just tell me the story about the decisions he made. And, you know, and then he, you know, and you'll see in the movie, obviously, that he tells the story that Adam just, you know, told us about, you know, what it meant to him in that moment and the decisions he made and how it changed his life. And I was in asking the question, heard those things in it. And I realized in that moment something really extraordinary about the movie we were making, because I had been making a movie up until that point about something, about a person who lost so much, given up so much. And that was the kind of profile and courage I was making. But after he told me that story, and it's in the film, and it's really, there was nothing more to say. I could barely ask another question after that, because I realized in that moment, this was actually a story about him regaining his inspiration. And it was about him regaining his spirit and energy and determination to serve. And that, in fact, he hadn't lost it, and that he, you know, was finding the energy to, you know, figure out how to continue in a way that was, you know, helpful to others. Maybe in small ways, maybe in big ways later in a political career. In that moment, by virtue of the way he answered that question, I realized that the whole movie kind of changed in that moment.
You know, I want to add to something, which is like, up until 6 months ago from today, I had no idea what became of her. I mean, I met her a year after that event, and then I heard nothing about her, right? And, you know, eventually the guy gets out of jail. He pleaded insanity. He was in jail for like 8 years or whatever, gets out, I think kind of turned his life around, thankfully. And 6 months ago, I end up somehow reconnecting with her, hearing from her. And, you know, she owns a dog grooming business, you know, has her own product line. And, you know, we don't talk a lot much. We don't talk about the event, but it was just kind of interesting. Even when I'm talking about it in the film, I have no idea what she's up to. And now, you know, to hear about it and to hear, you know, that she's made a life for herself, got remarried, had more kids. It's, you know, that's kind of, that's the kind of thing that can make a difference.
Adam Kinzinger. He's the subject in the documentary film The Last Republican. Steve Pink directed the film. It's the latest in our documentary film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it tonight at the Film Center's new building in the Marmalade District. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary The Last Republican. This is the latest in our film series. It's the story of Adam Kinzinger, who was ostracized by his party for speaking out against Donald Trump after January 6th. He lost his political future and he faced threats against himself and his family. And the film is about the costs of dissent, the personal side of politics, and whether civil discourse is even possible anymore. We have with us Adam Kinzinger and the film's director, Steve Pink. So there's this question that you raise early on in the film. It's like, I thought this was just going to be a party that got out of hand.
I called it, it was like Saturday morning when you had a giant party at your house Friday night, and now you got chickens flying around, you have a bad headache, you know, you're only wearing a shirt, and you're like, what did we do last night? That's where I thought the party was.
So your thinking, even at that moment, was the insurrection and the attempt to overthrow the government in a coup d'etat that included 140 Republicans voting to not certify the election. You thought that just might have been a crazy bender and that they were going to wake up and get their shit together.
Yep. You're going to wake up. You're going to deal with the hangover. And you're going to gut it out and drink water, right?
Can we just sort of talk about what is it about the incentive system or the sort of the moral structure of Washington that makes it so difficult for people to
do the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a combination of identity. Once, I mean, imagine I was congressman for 12 years and plus the time I was a candidate. Any room I walked into, short of it being the White House, I was the center of attention. And that becomes who you see yourself as. It becomes an identity. It becomes hard to give up, especially if you can see a route around giving it up. If I just acquiesce to a few things, even if you're not going to run, if someone's not going to run again, it's like, well, I want to go be relevant as a lobbyist and I want to have access to the people that I worked with. So I'm going to go quiet, which is why you see a lot of people quietly resign and never speak out so they can go still make their gajillions of dollars. And so, I think that's a big part of it. It's the lack of courage. And it's also, I'm not comparing it to this, and I want to be very clear, but often we wonder, how is it that somebody in Germany ended up manning a tower at Auschwitz? You know, in 1936, they never would have done it, but they were able to do it in 1943. And the answer is that humans are really capable of convincing themselves that anything they're doing is moral. You have to. Everybody, I mean, Adolf Hitler thought what he was doing was moral. Al-Qaeda thinks what they're doing is moral. You know, everybody, because humans have to have that ability. You're not going to do what you think is immoral. And so if you make a decision, I have to stay in office, you now convince yourself, okay, if I leave, somebody worse is going to replace me, or I need to stay. And so I got to do these things that compromise my integrity, what I believe, because I really care about the issue of prescription drug prices. And I want to work on that in my committee, or I care about rural broadband. And so in order to stay relevant in rural broadband, yeah, I have to say the election was stolen. And that happens. And, you know, in a way, the system's designed for it, because we're set up for re-elections every 2 years in the House. But also the founding fathers never intended for people to not have their own sense of moral centeredness. And unfortunately, that's where we're at in it right now, where people think they just go and do what they need to do to get reelected. But it's a combination of that plus what do you think is right? And so I think that explains a lot of it.
Is it true? Were you actually holding the baby when the Republicans censored you and Liz Cheney?
The RNC will be voting on a resolution to censure Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for their involvement in the investigation into January 6th.
Resolution to formally censure Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and to no longer support them as members of the Republican Party.
All of those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed, signify by saying no. The ayes have it and the five resolutions are adopted. Thank you, Richard.
We have the warm water ready for the bath.
Okay. Good job.
Dude, he's going to eat the whole thing. Should I just let him?
Let's maybe pull it out, Ian.
All right.
We'll give you to mom. Daddy. We'll figure out how this thing will go down.
Come on, my mama.
I thought it was a remarkable moment. We happened to be there. And then when that happened, you know, because I'm a terrible person, I was watching him get kicked out of a club I couldn't care less about, you know, yeah. I was like, you know, but I was like, but here was a person who had, you know, committed himself to a political party and they just threw him out over him standing up for his principles that they themselves were betraying.
That's
what kind of extraordinary, like. And it was sad. It was I could see that, despite the fact that I was like, hey, who cares? Let's go. Great, congratulations. You're no longer in a party that's given up its principles. You know, you've won. It's fine. It was not a great moment, you know, like this was the party that he was a part of for so long, and they just dismissed him out of hand for really reasons that themselves that are abhorrent to the democratic principles, which is just kind of, so it was kind of a shocking moment. And of course he's there with his new family. And so I felt myself, you know, trying to cheer him up in a way to no avail actually in that, you know, and then he decided to go for a run. I was like, well, we'll film him going for a run because he doesn't feel great. So he's going to go for a run and we'll just film him going for a run. And then we'll go and then we'll leave because it was just a kind of, you know, tragic really kind of a tragic inflection point in his life that happened, before our eyes.
Steve, you were talking about how the film kind of evolved organically from being this, oh, I'm going to do this piece about, it's going to be a profile in courage. And what it actually became was this film about how it is you engage with people you don't agree with. What did you learn about that, both of you? Like, what did you, because it seems to, that seems to be the question at hand for a lot of people. Some are asking it right now anyway, is on the right and the left, how do we engage people we don't agree with? Like, what did you learn any tricks? Did you learn any sort of any deep insights about all of that?
I mean, I sure did. I think it takes time, first of all. But yeah, I think there's lots of I can think of lots of social hacks as a result of, my experience making the film with Adam. And one of those is not talking about politics. Like, I don't need to know before I know, if I know absolutely nothing about you or your family or your life or your career or what you love, what you're passionate about, what kind of movies you like. Like what things interest you, I have no business asking them whether or not, or having an opinion about the fact that maybe they even believe that the election wasn't stolen, right? And that there was an attempted coup on Jan 6. You could meet someone, who believes Jan 6 was a hoax, right? And it could be my truly held belief that that's an insane position to hold, right? So what is my choice? Am I going to dismiss that person completely out of hand now? The person is my fellow American. There has to be something I agree with regarding this person. And that's what I need to find. I might ultimately be able to convince him that, there was an attempted coup d'etat on Jan 6 and that it was a violent insurrection and that Trump had no business pardoning people who themselves had pled guilty to seditious conspiracy. Nobody, bamboozled them into a guilty plea and yet Trump pardoned them. That's not where I have to start. I might ultimately be able, with facts and evidence, convince those people that the position they hold about those things isn't true. But there's no way in hell I would start there anymore. I wouldn't even come close. I would find out what football team they like and what food they like and what's important to their family and whether they like their job and what are the things that are challenging in their lives and what are the things that they love about their life. Long before I would ever ask them, why they hold a political point of view.
You'd try to talk them into why Caleb is the right quarterback for the Bears.
I mean, he might be a long line of tragic Bears quarterbacks, but I feel like they're 6-3, right? It was a tough win yesterday, but a win is a win. And yes, that's what you're absolutely right. That's what I would try and convince them.
I knew I'd get the right analogy.
I think we're going to be all right this year, man, but we keep barely winning. Okay. Anyway. So, one of the things I learned, I was already pretty much way more mature than Steve at this point on this, but, I definitely did learn, that, one of the things I've always kind of recognized is picking friends based on what they believe in politics is the stupidest thing to pick a friend on. And that's what we're doing. Like, honestly, I would much rather hang out with somebody that thinks differently than me on politics and somebody that thinks the same. If they think the same, it's boring. If they think differently and we respect each other's views, we may be able to talk politics and have a little disagreement. We may not. But I like to hang out with people I enjoy, drinking beer with or watching the Chicago Bears. And what I think was important about the film is showing people that, because weirdly, 10 years ago, if you'd have said, yeah, you can be friends with somebody that thinks different than you, nobody would believe that that's not a thing. Now it's like a new lesson for some reason. And hopefully some people can take some joy from that.
Maybe this is an annoying question, Adam, but, you say at one point in the film, Steve asks, you're having this conversation about when you were a young person having this debate and the debate was over abortion. And Steve asked, well, what side were you on? He's like, what do you think what side was I was on? I was on pro-life. And you say, I'm a Republican. And then there's this moment of uncertainty where you're like, or I was. I mean, and you end up sort of saying, I'm a something. Mm-hmm. So. What are you?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, look, the last 4 years I voted for Democrats. I haven't voted for a Republican in a long time. You know, I think the title of the movie is apt because it's like the party did leave me. It's like what Reagan said, used to say about the Democratic Party. The party did leave me. And so I feel like I'm kind of the last of the Mohicans, if you will, that's, you know, holding on to some values that Republicans used to believe because I refuse to relent. I mean, to me, if you ask, like, who is the conservative party in the United States right now, it's the Democrats, because they actually want to conserve the constitutional norms of this country. And so I guess if you would, by the definition of who do you vote for, that answer would be Democrat. In terms of, do you want to still annoy Republicans by calling yourself a Republican? The answer to that is yes. So as of now, I would call myself politically homeless.
Adam Kinzinger, he's the subject of the documentary The Last Republican. Also with us was the film's director, Steve Pink. We're going to be screening the film tonight at the Utah Film Center's new building in the Marmalade District. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER 90.1. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.